Good morning, members. There's no gavel here. It will be coming momentarily, but we don't have a quorum anyway. However, we will start. Welcome. We are on TV this morning. Take note of that. Thank you. And welcome back to PCA to begin or to continue with their overview. Tell us about what page you're on.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We are on page 17.
And if I remember correctly, when we started with Superfund, we left with a question on the table from Representative Moe. Representative Moe, do you want to start, or shall we give the outline of Superfund program first?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe it'd be up to the chair. I have a specific question, as you know, to one specific Superfund site. Maybe getting a little bit of overview and going back to that question might be more helpful for the committee, unless you have thoughts otherwise.
I think that's a good idea. Let's do your Superfund presentation and then pause for a moment for a question from Representative Moe.
Okay. Once again, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Leo Rodis, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the MPCA. And with me here again today is Lyle Mueller, the agency's finance manager. What I'll do for all the major programs in the agency as we move through the budget presentation is talk a little bit about what the program is about, just a bit about its history, and try to hone in on the outcomes that we think we've been able to achieve through these programs. And as we talk about something like Superfund, the outcomes are really going to be more long-term than in other programmatic areas because these cleanups tend to be fairly big and across many, many years. Just to jump in, the Superfund program is one of the major programs in our land program. And what this particular activity does is we identify, investigate, and determine the appropriate cleanup plans for abandoned or old hazardous waste sites located throughout the state. And this program was created back in 1990 by the federal government, and the state Superfund program followed in 1983. We project that our budget over the biennium will be $24 million, and we do this based upon the projects that we anticipate being able to work on over the course of the biennium. The list of the projects is updated periodically as we get more information and as we understand which projects are ready to go. Occasionally, we do get unanticipated costs as a result of things that we discover on a site. It turns out that a cleanup site needs more dollars to be able to finish the job than we need to make those adjustments. In terms of outcomes, the Minnesota Superfund program was created in 1983, and throughout the history of the program, there have been 255 sites that so far have been identified with the program, and we have taken action to clean up at 159 of the sites. And at those sites where we have completed the cleanup since 1980, we estimate that we have protected the drinking water supplies in and around those communities in 24 different communities, and that serves approximately 700,000 citizens in the state. We currently still have 96 active safe sites in the state, and we continue to work on these sites very actively and aggressively. We anticipate that within 6 years, all 96 of those sites will have initiated some level of response action. We get about 2 to 3 new sites per year. The sites that we tend to get these days are typically smaller than the larger sites that we've worked on in the past. That's not always the case, but that tends to be the case. And we also are finding that the sites that we're working on now, it's a little bit more difficult to do cost recovery on those sites because the responsible parties are not always very clearly known. I'll give you an example of a site just to give you a sense of what it is that we do on these sites and how big they can get and how many years it can take to clean up these sites. But a real good example is the Interlake Superfund site, which is up in the northeastern corner of the state. This is a site that has contamination dating back to the late 1800s. The contamination lasted from 1890s to about 1961, and we have 3 responsible parties who are working on the cleanup of this site. And the cleanup is focused on really restoring the ecological health of the river. The responsible parties pay for all the costs of the cleanup, including the PCA's time to oversee their work. There was a cleanup plan that was developed and agreed to by the PCA and the responsible parties within, I believe, the last year. And that cleanup plan was reviewed by a national peer review team to make sure that it's technically sound and is actually going to do the job that we expect it to do. The estimated cost for completing the cleanup of this site is between $50 and $70 million. The cleanup started in 2006, and this is basically cleaning up the sediment in the St. Louis River. And we expect the cleanup is going to be completed in about 2009. Now, before we jump into the petroleum remediation program, I understand there's a question about a specific
yes,
site.
Yes, I think there's going to be more than one question. Representative Mo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple more broad questions and then a site-specific question to a Superfund site in the district I represent. So with the Superfund program in Minnesota, I guess I would first question is I'd like to know how your agency makes priorities. Are they based on geography or public perception, or is there some real scientific means to determine that and where the resources go? And second, is there any leverage with the PCA to actually force the landowner to clean up, or is it just, are we pretty much just beholden to their goodwill to do so?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll pick the second question first, and then I'll ask the Division Director for the Remediation Division to talk about how we set priorities and the processes that we use for that. I think the leverage is there. We do have, under the MRLA statute, the ability to declare a pollutant a hazardous substance, which gives us a lot of authority to do cost recovery. Over the years, we have used that authority to do cost recovery. In cases where a substance is not actually listed as a hazardous substance, we are usually able to work out a cooperative agreement with the responsible parties to make sure that the cleanup happens, that they take the action that they need to take to clean it up and pay for all the costs. So I think we have a good track record. We've actually got, if you look around the country at the Superfund programs that are run by the various states, we are considered to be one of the best performing Superfund programs in the nation simply because we're able to get sites cleaned up fairly effectively. In other states, people tend to get bogged down in litigation, and it takes a long time to get some of these sites cleaned up. What we try to do when we decide whether or not we're going to take a firmer approach or a more aggressive approach with regard to regulation as opposed to cooperation is it really depends on the relationship with the responsible party and the approach that they take in addressing the problem. And for us, first and foremost, we're focused on what's the environmental benefit we're going to get. And if we think that we can get the outcomes we're after, which generally is about clean water, surface water, and groundwater, if we feel that we can get the outcomes that we want to achieve, we'll do that and pursue the appropriate approach. So I think our history is pretty good.
Madam Chair, all due respect, I have to strongly disagree with you. Let me give you some background here, and your agency can speak to it. There's a Superfund site in Cass Lake, Minnesota. It's been designated a Superfund site for 21 years. There are still almost 20 families living on the site. Your agency has been working on this for quite some time. And there's PCB, P, dioxin at the site. Kids living at the site. The remediation plan is to vacuum their carpets, drapes, put new sod down, tell their kids not to play in the yard on windy days, and on windy days to keep their windows closed. Yet we can't even move these families when the Chippewa National Forest has property in which they can be relocated to nearby. Yet we have no leverage with International Paper or anyone else to move those families off of that Superfund site. Yet, and all due respect to the people who are concerned about the 3M site, I am too, but we got this big PR nightmare for 3M down here, and we're all riding in on our white horses to clean this thing up. Yet we got 20 families in northern Minnesota because they're poor and they're native and they're still living on that Superfund site. It's inexcusable. and I'd like a response, and anything that we can do to mitigate this problem, we have to. We got to do it now.
Madam Chair, Representative, you know, we're similarly disappointed with the actions that are being taken on the site. To distinguish for the committee the way sites like this one are acted upon as opposed to the ones that the state has primacy on, what I want to make sure the committee understands that the federal government, most of the Superfund sites that we work on in the state are sites that we have primacy. In other words, we have the authority to go in and do the cleanup. In the site that you're referencing, that's one that the federal government has responsibility and authority for. We don't actually have the authority to order the actions the federal government does in this case. Our role in this kind of a situation, and it's rather infrequent in the state. Typically, we are the governing responsible or the responsible governing authority. That in this situation, our role is to provide technical advice and input on the cleanup actions that the federal government says needs to be taken. With all of our programs, whether it's the Superfund program or the air quality program that we delegated to run or the water quality program, we oftentimes have disagreements with the EPA on whether they're doing the right thing. And I'll tell you that we're disappointed with the way this one has played out as well. We're frustrated. We hear the concerns of the community. We wish we could do more. What we can do is continue to raise our objections with the EPA regional administrator in Chicago, as well as the EPA administrator in Washington, D.C., and let them know that this is a serious concern for the community. Having these kinds of conversations in a committee such as this is helpful for us because we can once again raise the concerns, and I can commit to you that we will do that. We'll place a phone call to the EPA regional administrator in Chicago and have a further conversation about this. As far as the details of how our authorities play out in a situation like this, I mean, I would have to defer to our regional or remediation division director to get into that in more detail.
Representative, I'm going to ask a question here on this one. Are you telling us that the federal law totally preempts any action by a state and that the federal law so covers it that we cannot act as a state? That is unusual in environmental areas, so help us out here. Is that the legal opinion of the Attorney General's office?
Madam Chair, I'll have to ask our Remediation Division Director, Kathy Sather, to come up and talk about this in more detail. This is beyond my...
I think it would be important to know that. Is that all right, Representative Moore?
That was my question. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Hi, I'm Kathy Sather, the Remediation Division Director for the Pollution Control Agency. Madam Chair, Representative. What's happened in this case is PPA actually was the lead on this site back in 1986. And in 1996, the leach band requested that the federal government, EPA, take the lead. So it's nothing that's in law. It's something that EPA is currently the lead of this project. So they have jurisdiction over actually doing the feasibility studies and determining what action. But we certainly, along the way, are providing technical assistance and working with them and providing input. But they finally get to make the ultimate decision as far as what happens with the site.
Madam Chair.
Representative Small.
Thank you for your comments. It would be the Leech Lake Band of Ojibwe, but that's okay.
Okay.
Thanks. What I don't understand, then, understanding their impatience after 10 years from 86 to 96, probably wanting, perhaps thinking that a federal agency might do better than 10 years at cleaning up the site. You know, I think that's a reasonable request on their part. However, how do we, as the state of Minnesota, the federal government is not going to clean this up. They have this long, drawn-out litigation process with these families. Literally, I mean, any representative here, if they had constituents living in this environment, too poor to move, frankly, they have no choice, and they can't let their kids play in the yard. How do we, in the state of Minnesota, take responsibility for this back and move these families to a safe place? You know, I mean, not even cleaning it up. Okay, we're kind of accepting that there's going to be this long, protracted cleanup process, may or may not happen in our lifetime. Whether I like that or not, that's another question. But we've got families who are living in a Superfund site, and they get their drapes vacuumed. I don't know. There's got to be some way we can take over control of this site.
And Chair Representative, yeah, I mean, I certainly understand your concerns, and I know that EPA is currently doing work right now on doing a feasibility study and determining recommended actions, but the reality of it is it's still probably a couple of years out that something would actually happen. So I would concur with what Leo had previously presented, is that we certainly can work with our folks in Region 5 and also at headquarters as far as relaying the concerns and see what we can do for the site to move it along and get some decisions. So I know back in when the last feasibility study was done, I know that that option to actually move the people off the site was proposed, but what was decided at the time was just the interim cleaning method, and it was my understanding at that time that the residents did not want temporary housing, but they may not have realized at that point in time what the impact of just the future cleaning really was, and that it wasn't going to be what might meet their needs.
Madam Chair, just and I apologize. I mean, I've been more involved in this. I mean, you've been in your position for 3 months, I think, so I appreciate your efforts to get up to speed on that. The families believed were instructed that they would have a permanent residence at this other location. Their alternative was to live in trailers someplace else. I think, you know, you've got them over the barrel, or we do. And since we're not going to clean up their site in perhaps in their lifetimes, we've got to do the right thing and find them a permanent house. So I would beg you, in your correspondence or your communication with the EPA, these families have to be moved. I mean, we've got to do a little triage here and make sure that they have their kids aren't playing in this stuff. I mean, it's really still unbelievable to me that this is going on.
Madam Chair, Representative, I guess I propose that we do a couple things after this. After these hearings conclude, is one is I'd like to sit down with you and talk about this in more detail and make sure that I really understand the full extent of the concerns, so that I get up to speed on it. And what I would suggest we do is after we or the commissioner calls USEPA in Region 5, is that we talk about sitting down with the communities and figuring out if the current solutions really are going to be unworkable in long term. Sounds like that's the case. So I think we can do that, and then with any luck, we can actually get this moving forward again in a satisfactory manner.
Thank you. Thank you for taking responsibility for that. Since this is federal government doesn't preempt the area, it seems that the state does need to be involved. You bring up a question to me about other sites, and I think it would be helpful to have a list of these 96 sites and your plan for each one of them, and how long out we are planning, because that certainly was a concern last 2 years ago about some sites were being moved back and not being taken up. So if we could have that list, that would be helpful. And secondly, is it this area that is paying for, we will deal with the 3M issue in the hearing on the 6th, I believe, but just to anticipate some questions and so you have the information, is it this area of lands that pays, or and specifically Superfund, that is paying for all the work that is being done around the 3M issue, number one, and are we being reimbursed for all of that, number two?
Madam Chair, we are being reimbursed for the costs that we incur to deal with the cleanup activities. What we're not being reimbursed for is some of the basic, for lack of a better term, R&D work that we do on the question of exactly where these are going in the environment and surface water development and the surface water criteria that we're doing on PSCs. There are a number of activities that fall within sort of our ordinary regulatory work that is not being cost recovered. The work that's specifically related to the sites that 3M is responsible for, we do cost recovery. We send them bills on a regular basis, and we haven't had any problem recovering our costs to date. So far, that's been working all right. And we can get you the figures on the totals as well.
It would be nice to have the figures on the cost of the research when you come back. Representative Coffey.
for Clem Hansen.
Oh, I'm sorry.
He was helping.
I was trying to help him.
He's a bigger one.
Farther down the table.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And on that particular point, and this may relate to the 3M issue, but also other issues, when you're saying we, you're referring to the, for cost recovery, you're referring to the Pollution Control Agency only, is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative, I can only speak to the cost recovery we do. It's my understanding that other agencies do not do cost recovery, but if I'm wrong on that, we will get you that corrected information.
And, Madam Chair, to follow up, so if the Pollution Control Agency is working with the Department of Health or other agencies on addressing multi-agency issues, they're under the various cost recovery statutes, you currently do or do not have the ability to recover costs.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll double check on that.
They
do not.
And Madam Chair, then is that a federal issue or is that something that we could take care of here in the legislature?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's not a federal issue, it's a state issue.
Thank you. Representative McNamara is next.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to follow up on what Representative Hansen talked about in relation to the 3M issue there. I would hope that when we come back and visit it, you said March. On March 6th, that we have the Department of Health here, because I think Representative Hansen and I know Senator Stephen, are all on the same page on this. We want to make sure that the agencies aren't taking any of their money that should be being used for other issues to take care of the issue at 3M. 3M should be paying for everything they're responsible for, and I want to make sure that the agencies are here when we have the hearing to find out if they're not, and if we need to change some state law to make that clear. This is clearly a product that they manufactured in their own hometown that's now showing up in the wells there that we need to deal with. And so I would just appreciate it if, like Mr. Stein from the Department of Health or whoever else could come, Madam Chair, if we could make sure of that. Thank you.
Representative McNamara, I can't make sure they'll be here, but I can make sure we'll invite them. Representative Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A quick question. Representative Moll, was the Superfund site you were talking about in your district, or is it in Representative Anzelk's district?
Madam Chair, Representative Hoppe, it's in my district.
Thank you.
Catholic.
Thank you. Representative Clark.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'm sorry I came in a little bit late, so I missed I think you might have talked a little bit earlier about the Superfund program. One of the questions I have is when there's a joint jurisdiction with other agencies, for example, you mentioned the Department of Health, but also around Superfund sites, the Department of Agriculture. So, for example, in an urban area, the inner city area that I represent in Minneapolis, we have a Superfund site related to arsenic pesticide, which is under the jurisdiction of the Department of Ag because it's an agricultural pesticide. Believe it or not, in an urban area, we have a big agricultural Superfund site. Okay, so one of the questions I have is we get different information from Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, from the EPA, and from our own Department of Health on what the values are in terms of what people can live with and what the cleanup values are. There's a lot of back and forth dispute about it, and the citizens are very concerned about it. And I'm just wondering, I mean, it seems to me one of the things that's been cited in terms of this arsenic is our own MPCA's value for cleaning up arsenic, I guess, in other areas, maybe if it's not an agricultural pesticide, is different from what the health department and the agriculture department say needs to be cleaned up. And that's different from what the federal government says. So we have kind of a mess in terms of people understanding what value they can live with, what's not safe for their children, and what's not safe for adults. And I'm just wondering, I mean, I have in the past tried to get some more communication between the agencies on that. And this is a real, you know, live issue right now of that lack of agreement or lack of communication. I'm just wondering, you know, what you can advise. Maybe we need to go back and try to change some laws about cooperation or understanding when someone who has the jurisdiction over the health and safety issues, when there are Superfund sites and when there's human exposure.
Do you have a? You didn't do it. Representative Clark, could we get answers in writing from the agency on that?
That would be fabulous. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Let's do that because we have a lot to cover. today. Representative Doty has the next question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're all familiar with the size of 3M cleanup and things like that, but on a small, very small scale, is your agency responsible for cleanup of former meth sites?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's my understanding that where we jump in is where if there's an emergency response action that needs to be taken as a result of a meth site, that we will work with that, work with the parties locally to do the cleanup and to hire contractors to do the cleanup. We've seen fewer of those, I believe, than we have in recent years, but it's still a concern for us.
And quick follow-up, would the contact come from county enforcement, local enforcement then, or private individuals that maybe ended up with that property?
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding is that it's our emergency response team that's called in to respond to these, and usually they get their information from a duty officer that would get that information from local officials to respond to that type of action.
Thank you.
Thank you. If you all will continue, we have lots to cover today, but lots of questions too.
Okay. I will jump next to the petroleum remediation program, which is the area of the remediation program that deals with overseeing the investigation and remediation of impacts from leaking tanks that are found underground. And these tanks could be an environmental problem because the product can leak into the soil and therefore into the groundwater, into the surface water. There's also a concern about vapors leaking into structures that might be nearby. We have a very strong working relationship with the Department of Commerce, from which we get most of the funding for this activity, as the Department of Commerce has the Petra Fund, which provides reimbursement to parties that do the cleanup, as well as pays for some of the costs of the program at the agency. As far as outcomes are concerned, this, again, is a long-term, we take a long-term view in terms of the cleanup outcomes from this program. We have over 16,000 sites that have been reported into this program since 1987, and more than 14,000 of those sites have been investigated and closed. That has resulted in more than 2 million cubic yards of soil being removed and treated, and that has also resulted in 850 million gallons of groundwater being treated, which is a fairly significant amount. We've had 700 sites that have required some form of emergency action, generally because of concern about wells or vapors in buildings. In 2006, we had 360 new sites reported. 470 sites were closed in 2006, and we also assisted 260 brownfield applicants who wished to remove tanks from their facilities so they could redevelop them. We currently have 2,500 active sites in this program, and as you can tell from what happened in 2006, we get new tanks in the program, and we also dispose of old cases. So it's a fairly dynamic program, and one that continues to see quite a bit of activity.
We have two questions, Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Deputy Commissioner, I'd like to ask you a little bit about this program. I had an incident in my district where this happened, and can you tell me how many of these, what's the percentage of these sites that you refer could have been or are determined to only just be the overflow, like in a diesel tank? It's my understanding that if you operate a filling station or a convenience store, the reality is that there'll be a little bit of natural overflow for the way it is, and that there'll be a little bit of diesel contamination in the soil right around the fill point. Does this program allow the flexibility to remove that soil and then determine that there's not a leaking tank and just have a simple process? And I got to be honest, before you answer it, no, I actually know the answer to that is not no. I should have prefaced that better. And I was very disappointed to see how the process worked. This is a great program that takes care of a lot of really sad situations of leaky tanks. But I think this blink on, blink off of, I think it's either 1 or 2 cents, has led to misuse and a little bit of diesel fuel in sand around a fill point has led to tens of thousands of dollars in a convoluted process between you and the Department of Commerce that really, from a state of Minnesota standpoint, we should be spending money dealing with Representative Moe's issue. and not this kind of stuff that I think sometimes we're doing.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Representative Moe's issue couldn't be taken care of with this problem because it's strictly for petrol contamination. And it's is this program scheduled to end at any time soon? And you say there's 2,500 more sites. I always hear it's going to end in 2 years or 4 years. Is there any truth to that? It's a great program.
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't think we have any immediate plans on the program simply because we continue to find new sites or new sites are reported to us. I think that as the newer tanks are installed over time, we'll get fewer leaks. But the fact of the matter is that any tank, no matter how well it's constructed, eventually is going to leak. So I think there's always going to be a need to have some level of activity in this area. The reason that it's key for us to make sure that we have a good, vigorous program in this area is that oftentimes having a leak site gets in the way of redevelopment of a site. So if you have somebody who wants to redevelop a property and they discover they have an old tank on site that they didn't know anything about, we can work with them to get that cleaned up. So I think it's going to be around for a while. As far as our specific projections as to when it's going to significantly ramp down, we can get you that information. The Remediation Division Director is informing me that there is a sunset statute that terminates the program in 2012 currently.
If you continue.
Okay, next is the Closed Landfill Program, which is a program that is responsible for overseeing the long-term maintenance, monitoring, and cleanup of landfills throughout the state. Now, this program was created back in 1994 as an alternative to treating these sites in the Superfund program. It was felt at the time that this would be more effective and efficient in getting these sites cleaned up and managed over the long term, and we think that's proven to be the case. We currently have 112 closed landfills that are considered to be qualified facilities under this program. And essentially, the way this program works is the state has taken over ownership of these facilities. We pay for the cleanup. We do cost recovery to the extent that we can and provide for the long-term care and maintenance of these facilities. We have complete construction at 100 sites, and 10 of the remaining 12 sites are eligible to receive bond funds, which is something that we will be coming back to the legislature next year to discuss. All I really want to talk about in terms of outcomes really comes down to the way we manage leachate and methane that is released from these facilities. All municipal solid waste landfills will release leachate. This is the liquid that comes off of the landfills and also will generate methane gas as a result of the decomposition of the trash. What we're doing is we're making sure that we can, at minimum, collect all the methane that is generated off of the facilities in the program. We collect 28 million pounds of methane annually from these facilities. However, from an environmental perspective, that's really a lost opportunity, and what we're trying to do is to move all the facilities where we can to capture this gas to use it for electricity generation. We recently were able to get a program an effort underway in Andover where we started to capture and use the methane as a fuel source for electricity, and that project is generating 220 kilowatts of energy. We think that if we were to develop all the landfills in the program to generate electricity, we'd be able to generate an additional 8 to 10 megawatts of electricity, which would be enough to power 9,300 homes in the communities. As far as leachate is concerned, the outcome that we're focused on is making sure that we adequately capture and treat the leachate that is coming off of these facilities so that it does not end up in the groundwater. And we do that both through prevention and capture of the leachate that's coming off the sites. So when we construct the fix for these sites, we'll do things such as put on improved landfill covers, try to reduce the waste footprint, and do effective leachate collection. And we think that through these activities, we are annually avoiding generation of about 100 million gallons of leachate.
The question is not how much do you avoid. The question is how much is still leaking? What percentage is still leaking? That has been the measure you've used, and that is the measure we should be asking about.
Madam Chair, if we don't have that answer, we will get that to you
Right. If you would bring me that, or bring us that answer, and also how many sites are you capturing methane at, and how many sites are you not capturing methane at? If you can bring us that information, and then Representative Gartner has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually had a couple, and not all of them needed to be answered now. One was related to the methane issue. If you could also include in that information the threshold at which the volume allows you to feasibly collect methane as opposed to flaring it, because I know there are some landfill sites that are where the material is vented over time anyway, and there isn't much volume or pressure to make it feasible. So, I mean, I know that not all of them are able to have leachate system. My other question that someone could just get back to the rest of us on, too, and this is related to the renewable energy standard, because landfill gas was inserted in the Senate version, which is one what we adopted that wasn't originally in the House version. I'm curious about how that renewable energy standard is going to affect the economic feasibility of putting more landfills in with landfill gas. And then the third one, and I don't, I should know this by now, but the solid waste management tax is roughly half of it has gone to the closed landfill cleanup program, and it's worked really, really well. And I think Representative Boginis helped work on that when it was first formulated. But it's actually really helped clean up more sites more quickly at less expense than if we just let it go and let Superfund proceedings go in. So I think it's been a model that other states ought to be doing. It's actually brought in so much money that I've never quite been clear what we need the bonding authority for, and I'm sure there's a simple answer for it, but I guess that's my question.
If we could get those numbers from you in writing, we'll make sure our members of the committee could get them.
Yeah, and I don't need the answers for that now, Madam Chair. We can just move on to.
Well, we'll make sure that everyone gets them, even the folks who are not here. Representative Clark?
Just a quick question, and maybe this is for later, too. I don't know. Is this the program that deals in with, for example, the heavy metals that are deposited in landfills from, for example, the cleanup of the arsenic I just mentioned to you that's taken to a landfill, I think, up by upriver, and then the construction when they're cleaning up lead in housing and they're put into a landfill program. Is this that program or is it a separate program?
Madam Chair, Representative, these are closed landfills, so they don't accept any additional waste. I'll be talking in a few minutes about the agency's solid waste program as it relates to active facilities.
Thank you.
You want to go ahead?
Okay. The next program is the Voluntary Investigation and Cleanup Program, which we affectionately call the VIC program. It's a very well-managed program, in my opinion, that allows us to provide oversight and investigations of cleanup actions on a voluntary basis. Essentially, this is a program where somebody's interested in redeveloping the site and wants to do so in an expeditious manner, they can pay for our services to ensure that the cleanup takes place and that they are absolved of any future liability as a result from the past contamination. It's a fairly popular program because we're able to provide the services relatively quickly, and we're able to allow redevelopment to move forward expeditiously. It's especially important in urban areas that are trying to redevelop sites that may be blighted because of past contamination. In terms of outcomes, we have returned, according to our estimates, over 14,000 acres of land back to productive use. And what we mean by productive use is that they are able to be sold or refinanced or used for some other redevelopment purpose. The Emergency Response Program is a small program for the agency in terms of staffing and dollars, but it is a very, very important program for the agency. It's a 24/7 operation that we have that is in place to respond to approximately 2,500 incidents per year. Some of them can be quite serious. Some of them can be smaller spills. Typically, it is our practice to go after facilities who are responsible for the spills, to do cost recovery, and that is usually what we're able to do. On occasion, we are not able to do cost recovery, either because we have a recalcitrant party and we pursue enforcement action against those folks, or we just simply don't know who the responsible party is. In fiscal year 06, we used state funds 51 times to do the response because we just simply didn't know who the responsible party was, or we weren't getting an adequate response in terms of cost recovery.
Representative Smith has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about mercury. I've had a couple mercury spills in schools in my district in the last month, and wondering if that's covered under this program, and typically how many mercury spills do we have in a year in a school setting?
Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have those figures, but we'll be happy to get those to you. What happens is, similar to the earlier question about how we respond to meth labs, is if we get a call from the incident commander on the site that they need the PCA's assistance, we will jump in action and work with the locals to do the cleanup and bring contractors into place to be able to execute the appropriate cleanup action. Sometimes the locals feel that they can manage this themselves. The contractors are fairly well known, I think, at least some of the incident commanders. But there are instances where we need to jump in, and we can get you the numbers as far as how many of the mercury spills we're responding to.
Why don't you give those numbers to the committee, and we'll get them out to everyone. You want to go on?
Okay, next is hazardous waste management, which is one of the older programs at the agency, and really flows from requirements at the federal level in the what's known as the RCRA law, Resource Conservation and Recovery Act law. This is an important program because it not only deals with management of waste, but it also has a prevention focus, which I'll talk about in just a minute. Minnesota businesses generate about 250,000 tons annually of hazardous waste, and what this program does is it works to ensure that those wastes are appropriately managed and treated as appropriate. We have over 18,000 permitted or licensed facilities in the state, and the way that breaks down is we have 26 treatment, storage, and disposal facilities. The largest one is in Eagan, Minnesota. We have 258 large quantity generators, which puts us about in the middle of the pack for the rest of the nation, and just in terms of numbers. By and large, the greatest number of generators that we have in the state are called the very small quantity generators. We have 16,200 of those generators, and these are very, very small quantity generators. And we really try to take a more of a prevention focus in dealing with these folks because it's simply not practical to regulate them the way we did with the larger facilities. Now, I'll give you an example of a prevention-focused program, which does have a compliance aspect to it as well. But it's a program that I wanted to highlight because I think the outcomes are ones that we're particularly proud of, and we think it's a good example of how we can take innovative approaches to deal with emerging issues. We decided a little while ago to start up a healthcare initiative, and that was based upon some data that we were seeing that led us to believe that hazardous waste and medical waste weren't being all that well managed in the hospital sector. And we entered into a partnership with the Metro Counties, the Minnesota Hospital Association, the Minnesota Technical Assistance Program at the University of Minnesota to really try to get a handle on waste generation at hospitals. We've worked with over 100 hospitals across the state, but the real focused activities are with 28 metro hospitals that are working with us in this program. I think the outcomes that we've been able to see from this program, which has taken about 1.5 staff time, are pretty impressive. We have managed to work with the hospitals to make sure that 75 tons of pharmaceuticals are being properly managed. 30 tons of laboratory waste are also being properly managed. We don't know how that compares to what we saw before, but we do know that in many instances those wastes were not being properly managed. In terms of pharmaceutical waste, I think a lot of that was because there just wasn't a lot of knowledge about what the impact of these pharmaceuticals are having on the environment, especially in terms of things like endocrine disruption. We've also been able to document that over 1,000 pounds of mercury has been eliminated at these healthcare facilities. We're also properly managing things such as formalin, which is a problem when it's discharged in the sewer.
When you say properly managed,
in terms of pharmaceuticals, what is the management you use?
Madam Chair, I'm not precisely sure.
If you could get back to us on that, too.
We could do, I believe we have quite a bit of information on this initiative, so we can provide that to the committee.
What do you do with the pharmaceuticals in the end? Thank you.
Okay, next is the Solid Waste Management Program, which gets to the question that Representative Clark was asking earlier. This is the program through which we oversee currently active land disposal facilities in the state. And we oversee operations at 260 permanent facilities, and they fall into four major categories. We have 21 municipal solid waste landfills. We have 100 demolition landfills, which accept demolition waste, 35 industrial landfills, and 104 transfer stations. And the transfer stations are smaller facilities that take waste from one place to another. And even though they're small facilities, they tend to generate a lot of controversy for the agency when those are permitted. We inspect these facilities at least once per year. If we have a problem facility, we will inspect them more than once per year. And we find that the compliance in the industry is overall pretty good. We have 98% compliance rate, and what that means is that these facilities are in compliance with their permit requirements 98% of the time. More than 90% of our permits are also up to date, which means that we actually we have standards and requirements in place that are up to date and state of the art. As far as outcomes in this program, we estimate that 75 million gallons of leachate are generated through the facilities that are regulated by this program are collected and treated every year. And since we have a very good compliance rate, we feel that virtually all that leachate is being properly managed. And we feel like we've got a pretty good handle on that. Of course, like in any program, we feel like we can always do better. But we think this is a program that we have fairly well in hand.
In terms of the leachate, is there leachate coming from any of these landfills now that is not being, that is just going out and not being contained?
Madam Chair, Kathy Moger is nodding her head yes, so I will ask her to come up and talk about that for a moment, if that's okay.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Kathy Moger. I'm the Division Director for Prevention and Assistance, but I'm subbing for Lisa Thorvig today, who's in Alexandria. We do have some of the older facilities who do still have unlined cells. When we passed our state regulations, we required lined cells or lined liners for the landfills far ahead of the federal government, but we still do have old cells that discharge to the environment, and we're monitoring those cells and making sure that they're not causing issues. But everything basically since the late 80s has had liners and leachate collection systems, but if they had older cells, those would be unlined.
For those that are unlined, we don't have pump and treat systems for those.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, only if they're causing environmental or public health problems, then we would require treatment. But other than that, no.
Okay. I'm a little concerned about that. Representative Clark.
Just real quick, can you just tell me in terms of what I was asked about earlier, the landfills that deal with the lead construction, the construction materials that where we're cleaning up lead debris, and then also the arsenic that's being taken off the soil. I've had a lot of people ask, you know, what do we know about where that's going, and is it going to be causing anybody else problems? So look at this.
Madam Chair and Representative Clark, each of our solid waste landfills is required to have what's called an industrial waste management plan. That basically is unique to that facility and the type of waste that it might accept. And it basically sets out what can and can't be taken at that particular facility. And then it says, based on that type of waste, how that waste should be managed at that facility. Sometimes that means that the waste can go in with the mixed garbage. Sometimes it means that they have to be managed separately. All of that kind of waste, of course, would go into a lined and leachate collected landfill.
Representative Anfield, that was the question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The year 1994 appears to be a significant year because that is when the closed landfill program apparently was funded and begun. I was a county commissioner a long, long time ago. And my first question is, do leachate and methane issues ever go away, or do they ever are they ever solved? And secondly, can we be comfortable that somebody, either the public health agency in county government or the PCA or somebody somewhere, is still monitoring old landfills dating back to the early 80s, as an example?
Before you answer that question, I think we need to make a distinction between the old landfills and a huge parcel of dumps that even predated the landfills, and I think is still an outstanding question for Minnesota. So if you could address that, Ms. Mulgar.
Madam Chair and members, for the closed landfill program, we do have a schedule set up of basically what we call perpetual care. There is a long-term plan for each of these landfills that says at what point we think we're going to have to stop collecting leachate or doing the treatment, and then from there, how often we're going to check the monitoring around those landfills. As Representative Wagenius pointed out, those are landfills under the state's responsibility. The open landfills, the currently operating landfills, also have a similar plan that's required by rule by the Pollution Control Agency. And then the open dumps that Representative Wagenius is talking about are basically there until discovered, or often we remediate those during a brownfields action when someone is trying to redevelop that particular site.
Do you mean open dumps or dumps that are closed?
Well, closed open. We call them open, Representative Wagenius and members, we call them open dumps because they never had any cover, they were often burned, they were pretty much open to the environment.
Okay, and then there was one more question, Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to attest to the fact that the PCA does address some of those unlined cells. Well, they did their, I guess you're still doing the Winona County landfill, or where they're actually digging out the old unlined cell, putting in a liner, and then plopping it back in. It's a little bit better than just whipping out the tablecloth with leaving everything there. I don't know. But it works. And then in Clay County, I know they've replaced the cell. My question related to construction and demolition debris. Municipal solid waste landfills do have to have the liners. Construction demolition debris landfills don't necessarily. I mean, they have to be in a firm layer of clay, I know, but there was a, if you could update us on the rulemaking process that went on a couple of years ago where the greater Minnesota counties didn't want to invest in seeing a requirement for liners for construction and demolition debris, and a lot of the private metro ones wanted the liners because they already had the liners. Wisconsin doesn't distinguish between them. They mix construction and demolition and municipal solid waste together. Should we move in that direction? Is the question still open? Are there unique hazards to construction and demolition debris from shingles, treated wood, and the like that we should be looking out for?
Madam Chair and Representative Gardner, this is going in a direction that I only have a minimal level of experience with, so I'll tell you what I know, and then I think we might have to get back to you with further information. The agency just worked very closely for, I think, 3 or 4 years with the counties to come up with a guidance manual that basically helps the operators of those facilities determine how they should treat waste that come into their facilities. A lot of the demolition facilities are unlined, but the larger ones are lined and leachate collected. And so it really does depend on the size of the facility and the types of waste that they're accepting. And beyond that, we'll have to, if you have further questions, we'll have to get to additional information.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you. And just so I don't interrupt later, I was going to compliment your staff on doing a great job with the eco experience, by the way. And also on construction and demolition debris, I know that you work in market development stuff for finding out what to do with the old shingles, for example. So I'm not here just to give you a hard time. I think you guys are working on trying to get some of the nasty stuff out of there in the first place.
Representative Johnson. Thank you, Madam Chair. And regarding demolition landfills, what then would be the process? For instance, a demolition, private demolition company would, say, take down a bank building. Is PCA involved with looking for PCBs or any other hazardous substance that may be in an old building that's being demolished and deposited on site?
Madam Chair and Representative, that's what part of the guidance manual is about, is really helping the local officials who are closest to where the building is being demolished to actually go out there and understand what's in the waste, and for the operator to be able to visually inspect the waste before it comes into the facility. We've also put on some training seminars for local officials so that they can start to that they better understand what it is that they're looking for, what potentially might cause problems. For the very, very small sites, if it's just like taking down a building or something of that nature, we do have permit by rule that basically allows a facility to be dug and the building deposited in that, as long as it has been inspected for those materials to be taken out and then covered up.
Representative. So then if somebody demolished buildings, for instance, before 1985, what process do you follow then to reinspect those sites where they are? And there are some in the metro area.
Madam Chair and Representative, I believe that for the majority of those, that we tend to find those as the sites are redeveloped, that we are not going back and reinspecting them.
Thank you for this. One of the things when you get back to us and get back to all of us is let us know about the assurance funds on the demolition and construction landfills that do not have liners. I think the question there is making sure that the assurance fund is big enough to take care of any problems that might happen. So let us know about that and that the funds are fully funded. Thank you. If you want to go on.
Okay, next we're going to move into the next major environmental programmatic area for the agency, which we call environmental assistance. And most of the work that I'll be talking about here is work that was previously done in the Office of Environmental Assistance before they were combined with the old PCA into the new PCA that we have today. So what I'll do, as I did in the land program, is I'll talk a little bit about the vision and the key goals, give you a brief budget overview, and talk about some of the activities and the outcomes that we're able to accomplish in this area. The vision for environmental assistance is quite simply to work with Minnesotans to see that they take responsibility to protect our environment. And really this area is focused on taking individual and institutional action so that environmental problems are prevented for the future. Now, the key goals break up into three main areas. We have a goal that's focused on working with with individuals and companies to buy green products and services. We also have a goal that focuses very squarely on working with businesses to produce green products so that those products are more widely available to consumers who wish to purchase them. And then finally, we have a goal that's a fairly big goal, which is that Minnesotans act on their environmental knowledge to be able to make better environmental decisions which will support healthy ecosystems. And it really is important for the last one to work that we have adequate support for the first two goal areas so that there's a good marketplace out there for people to be able to act upon their knowledge. Now let's talk very briefly about the assistance activities, and then I'll head a little bit more into more detail a bit later with some discussion on outcomes. But the areas, we really have three major areas in our assistance program. One is the recycling programs, which is work that we have been doing for quite some time and has been a major focus for what was then the OEA and is now our environmental assistance program area in the PCA. Our estimate is that just over the past 2 years alone, that pollution prevention activities that work both in recycling and waste prevention activities have saved businesses nearly $4.5 million and has prevented or reused nearly 12 million pounds of waste. And this also has associated energy conservation benefits, which can be quite significant. Very briefly, I'll just talk about the eco experience, which Representative Gardner mentioned. This is really a highlight for us in as far as what we've been able to produce with the new agency. We had a new exhibit at the State Fair this year, which was a first of its kind for not only our State Fair, but for state fairs across the country. And the exhibit was focused on providing consumers, citizens, with information about how to make healthier and better environmental choices. We had over 350,000 visitors come through the building. It was the second most popular exhibit in the State Fair. The State Fair has eagerly welcomed us back, and I think we have another 4 years on our lease at this building, so we're very excited about that. Just a brief overview most of the organizational slice of this. We do, as I mentioned, most of the assistance work in the area where most of the former OEA folks are housed, and that's in our Prevention and Assistance Division. The funding picture for this area is pretty simple. It's virtually all environmental fund. I'll give you a breakdown of where these dollars go because I think it gives you a good sense of what our priorities are. The largest slice of the pie is the SCORE grant. And with the governor's recommendation of adding $1.5 million per year to the SCORE program, that would bring it to $28 million over the biennium, which is more than half of the $49.5 million that is appropriated to environmental assistance. I'll also be talking about a change item that we're proposing that deals with green fleets and green fuels and green energy, which is a total of $3 million. We also have household hazardous waste grants to local communities in the amount of $2.1 million. Another big area for us is our core environmental assistance operations and programmatic work, which funds a lot of the staff and the baseline work that happens in environmental assistance, and that totals at $9.7 million. Before I talk about the activities that we do in this area, I just want to talk a bit about the trends in waste management and our goals for where we wish to be, which is not the direction that we're currently heading. This gives you, I think, a pretty good idea of the trends in waste management in the state going back to 1992. As you can see, the trend has been heading upward. We're seeing increasing amounts of municipal solid waste being generated in the state. In 2005, it totaled at 6 million tons, which is about 1 ton per person per year. The generation rate is increasing at about 2% per year. And while we have a very healthy recycling rate, it's currently at 41%, which is the second highest rate in the nation. It's not keeping pace with the rate of growth in municipal solid waste generation overall. A disappointing trend is the trend in waste to energy, and that's declined from 38% to 20%, and we have goals that we've set for this area to try to turn that around. We've also seen an increase in landfilling, going from 23% to 35%. And we think that as we increase the percentage of recycling and the amount of waste being used for waste energy projects, we think that we'll be able to work against that goal and try to bring landfilling rate back down. Now, this picture tells you the story of where our strategic plan is focused with regard to waste management. And if you look out to 2012, which is the last bar chart on the right, that basically describes where we want to be with regard to our recycling rate and our waste energy and composting rate by 2011. Our goal is to get back or get to a 50% recycling rate by 2011, and we also have a goal of achieving 35% waste energy and composting rate by 2011. We have a number of activities that we do in this area to try to get to that point. Just to give you some facts that will flesh out the picture a little bit, by our estimates, Minnesotans currently throw away in the landfills the energy equivalent of 30 trillion BTUs annually, and that's a huge lost opportunity. We think that recycling avoids the use of virgin feedstocks and would also be very beneficial in terms of saving energy throughout the system. Now, if we achieve the goals that I just talked about, the 50% recycling rate and the 35% waste energy rate, we think that what that would result in is avoiding 2.6 million tons of carbon dioxide being emitted into the air every year, and would conserve an additional 15 trillion BTUs every year. Now I'll talk a little bit about the activities that we do in the environmental assistance area. And after this, I'll talk in more detail about the SCORE change item, which we know is quite important to our county partners. First of all, there is a wide range of activities that we undertake in the environmental assistance area. I'm just going to highlight a few of those areas. And as I mentioned earlier, the recycling industry is very important in the state. We think it's not only environmentally positive, but it's an economic engine for the state. By our estimates, 15,000 jobs have been created in this business sector alone, and it represents about $2.3 billion in gross economic activity. The activities that we work on are basically providing assistance to individuals and businesses who are looking to find ways to recycle and reduce and reuse products that would otherwise end up in our landfills. Now, as I mentioned, we did do the Living Green Expo, the Eco Experience at the State Fair last year. For the last few years, we've also had an event called the Living Green Expo, which is something I've personally been associated with since its inception and very excited about. And it's an event that takes place around Earth Day, and it's a great event for providing people information to make better environmental choices. Now, onto the SCORE change item. As you recall, I mentioned that we are proposing that $1.5 million per year be restored to the SCORE grant. And just a little bit of background on SCORE. This is the primary way in which the agency works with county partners to support recycling and waste management and prevention programs. Back in 2004, unfortunately, these funds were reduced to $12.5 million per year because of the tough budget circumstances. And it's our understanding that at that time, the legislature signaled its intention to work with the agency to restore those funds when the budget situation improved. We feel that that's the case today. So what we proposed in the governor's budget is to restore those levels back to the pre-2004 level so that it would be back at $14 million per year. We think that this is a wise investment because our estimates show that more than 1 million tons of easily recognizable and recyclable materials end up in the waste stream. And we think that making sure that we have good and vigorous county programs, particularly in the rural areas where the reductions were, I think, especially felt, we think that these are dollars that could really do a lot of good. Now, just to remind the committee, for those of you that are not familiar with SCORE, the counties are required to leverage these state funds at least 25%. Many counties match it to a far greater extent. We think, again, especially in the rural counties, we think that this will be a significant help for their programs.
Representative Gardner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just flipping through to make sure that I didn't miss anything, but I didn't see any information about your work on product stewardship. You've done a lot of pretty progressive stuff on carpet, paint, electronics. Representative Saylor has a bill which has just got passed through the Environmental Policy Committee, and I guess I'd like to see how what would happen, for example, if an electronic waste infrastructure was set up for recycling, that how that integrates with SCORE and your overall policy making activities, and are there any other products you're looking at?
Madam Chair and Representative Gardner, we do have a healthy activity in the product stewardship area. You mentioned electronics, and of course that is one of the areas that's been active at the legislature for a number of years, and that we've been providing technical information and helping the counties with their program areas. We're also working on carpet areas, and that's being done at the national level, and we do have interest in, as a result of that, interest from a manufacturer to locate in the state. It's very similar to, if you're familiar with our Get the Lead Out program, where we're trying to get people to exchange their lead sinkers with non-lead alternatives. In concert with DNR, as a result of that, we had a facility that decided to change over from pure lead sinkers to the tungsten alternative, and has now created more jobs that way. So we think our product stewardship efforts yield good results. The other area that we're working on is on paint, and we're part of a national task force that's working with manufacturers to set up a manufacturer responsibility for latex paint.
Madam Chair, I just bring it up because it's a good story, and I think you should tell it some more next time.
Thank you. Okay, do you want to continue with Eric?
Okay, next I'll be moving into the AIR program. Just on a personal note, this is an issue that is one that I'm intensely interested in, as I spent about half of the first half of my career as an environmental professional, air quality, doing risk assessment work, regulatory compliance, and also working on mobile source pollution prevention. So it's an area of great personal interest with me. To start out again, as we have with the other programmatic areas, I'll just talk a little bit about the vision, which is, I think, fairly simple and straightforward, and is one that's easily understood, which is that we want Minnesota's air to be clean and clear. And there's a lot of technical information that supports that as far as what is clean and what is clear, but we think that's a fairly clear statement of where we think we ought to go. In terms of the key goals that we have for air quality is, one, we want to make sure that the air is going to meet or be better than all the environmental and health-related standards that are out there for air quality. That's either at the state or federal level. But we also think it's very key to focus on reducing our share of regional and global pollutants. Now, just to give you a little bit of backdrop on our perspective on air quality, the standards don't tell the whole story, as you'll hear in a minute. Now, clean air does mean that we have healthier people. It's clear that we can show that there are demonstrable health effects from high levels of air pollution, and in some cases even moderate levels of air pollution. And we also know that when we have cleaner air, we have cleaner water. There are mercury is deposited into our lakes and streams from the water. So what we do in managing air quality also has a beneficial effect in improving our water quality. Air quality is also important in distant and far-flung places such as the boundary waters. We have issues related to visibility in those otherwise pristine areas, and we have efforts in place to try to address those serious issues, which are also federally regulated issues. Now, when I talked about standards not telling the whole story, we do meet all federal air quality standards. And we think that's a good thing, but that doesn't really tell the whole story, because for certain pollutants, there are health effects that we see even below the federal standards, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. Now, the air work in the agency takes place in three major divisions. Our industrial division is where we do the bulk of our regulatory work, and this is regulating things such as power plants, mining facilities, major manufacturing facilities, and even just your small garden variety body shop down the street. We also do work in the Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division. That's where we do the monitoring and assessment work, and we also do our risk assessment work. And then finally, in prevention and assistance, we have a number of activities that we've been doing in recent years to work on prevention of particularly mobile source pollution as it affects residents, particularly in the metropolitan area. This is a picture of the air quality budget. Historically, we have not had much, if any, general fund in the air quality budget. That's the aspect of this that I want to highlight, because I'll be talking about it as part of a budget initiative and the governor's recommended budget that seeks to provide greater support to our regulatory activities focused on the ethanol and mining sectors. So that is going to be a general fund initiative that I'm going to talk about. Most of the dollars in the environmental fund come from fee sources such as the air quality fees that we collect from the larger and medium-sized facilities in the state. Now, here's a picture of how we're doing in Minnesota. Now, I'll just for a moment, I'll say that you should try to keep what you're seeing here in mind as we talk about water later on, probably at the next hearing. Because the way we're able to assess and understand what's happening in air quality is very, very different from what we can do in water quality. The reason it's different, and the reason I think we feel better about what we can say about trends in air quality, is that air quality mixes fairly readily. We can, with a fair degree of confidence, place monitoring stations across the state and get a pretty good idea of what the level of air quality is overall. It doesn't mean that we don't have hot spots that we need to be concerned about, but in general, we think we've got a pretty good understanding of the air quality picture. Now, what you see in this graph is not only air quality trends, but also trends related to some of the drivers of air quality emissions. The top line on the chart, I think, is very instructive, as it just shows you how much economic development is taking place in the state in the form of the real gross state product. Now, that's important because as we have more economic development, you have more facilities going in, you have more vehicle miles traveled, which you can also see on the graph, and the more vehicle miles that we travel, the more pollutants that we put into the atmosphere. Now, even though we're seeing these fairly significant upward trends in the gross state product, we have seen a very consistent decline in emissions of what we consider our traditional pollutants that we regulate at facilities across the state. We think that's a good thing. It means we've got a pretty good handle on the emissions of most of the industrial facilities across the state. That doesn't mean there isn't room to improve, and there are a number of things that have taken place in recent years to get emissions of some of these pollutants down even further than we have them today. But we think it's an area that we have a fairly decent handle on, at least in terms of understanding what the issues are before us. The one cautionary trend I'd like to highlight is the middle line for carbon dioxide at 53%. That's been a fairly steady incline over the years, and we're concerned about this for obvious reasons, because it's a primary driver of climate change. Now, I'll just talk a little bit about what the picture looks like with regard to the federal ambient air quality standards, and specifically talk about it in the context of particulate matter. Now, particulate matter is probably the most important. All the pollutants we regulate are important, but particulate matter is especially important because the health effects of even low levels of particulate in the air can be quite serious, and it's something that we're very, very mindful of and do everything we can to mitigate. Now, the trends that you're seeing here in terms of the ambient air quality trends for particulate matter are very similar to what we see for volatile organic compounds and nitrogen oxides as well. So I think it gives you a good sense of what the trends are for the pollutants. What's different here is the information about the particulate matter standards. Now, the top solid yellow line that you see is the current standard, and this comes from the federal government. The federal government is responsible and authorized by the Federal Clean Air Act to set ambient air quality standards based upon health. And this is the current standard that they have today. They are in the process of lowering that standard, as they are required to periodically reevaluate their air quality standards and make adjustments if necessary. The dotted line that you see is the standard that has been recommended by an advisory committee to the US EPA as far as what the appropriate level ought to be. EPA hasn't said precisely where they're going to set the standard. There's been some debate at the federal level about whether EPA is being aggressive enough. We didn't see that where the level is that EPA is contemplating right now because, frankly, we're not precisely sure where they're going to end up. We're pretty confident that the level is going to be somewhere in between the dotted line and the solid line. What that means in terms of our ongoing ability to comply with federal ambient air quality standards is that we still think we will comply with the new lowered federal ambient air quality standard. However, that doesn't mean that we don't have work to do in reducing particulate emissions.
When I look at this chart, I see what happens over a year, but people don't breathe average air. They breathe air hour by hour and day by day. And I had asked you to do a chart on fine particulate matter and how many bad hour air days there were. And I had asked if you would include that in this so folks could see. And I don't see that in here. Could you all bring that for next time? Just so members know that. And also, as I look forward to the next on benzene, it's the same issue. People don't believe averages.
Madam Chair, so we're sure exactly what it is you're looking for. Could you describe again the graph that you...
Well, you all have already done it for me.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yes. People know.
And that should be easy.
That should be easy.
We will do that. Okay, on to benzene. I think the story is very similar. We have seen the trends for benzene, and the trend for formaldehyde is somewhat similar. We're calling out benzene in the presentation because we think it's a fairly instructive example for what's happening with toxics and how it relates to the health benchmark, which is set by the Minnesota Department of Health. We have seen the overall trends in benzene heading downward for a variety of reasons. Most likely, the result for this downward trend is that the fuels that we use, gasoline primarily, has been lower in benzene content over the last few years. There was also an action that was taken by the legislature to require vapor recovery at gas stations in the metropolitan area, which has had some effect in reducing benzene emissions. And also cars are getting cleaner. The federal government continues to crank down on what's allowed to come out of motor vehicles across the country, and we think that's having an effect on this trend.
One of the several issues I see here, and I hope we talk about them next time as you come, one is this benzene health benchmark. It's a benchmark that is set for adult males. And we don't have a child-based standard, as far as I know, for benzene. And, of course, kids breathe a lot more air for body weight than adults do. So our health department is way behind in doing standards. But the thing I would want you to bring for us next time is looking not just at year by year and looking at averages, but looking at, do we have bad air days for benzene? Do we know what people are really breathing since they don't breathe average air? And help us out with that.
Okay.
You could do that?
We will do our best.
Thank you.
Okay, this I think is a transition to talking about the levels of pollution that we're seeing in the state and where we think we'd like to head. This slide is really focused on particle and ozone formation in the state, and we have a goal in our strategic plan to reduce the emissions of pollutants that contribute to particulate and ozone formation by 30%. Now, for ozone formation, the most critical pollutant in this state is nitrogen oxides, or NOx. In other states, depending on their particular regional or local circumstances, it might be volatile organic compounds. But for us, it's NOx. Now, we set the goal to reduce these emissions by 30% by 2011. We think we're going to be close. It's more likely that we're going to reach that goal at around 2012, perhaps 2013. The major drivers in reducing the emissions of these pollutants are the activities that have been undertaken by some of the major emitters in the state, primarily Xcel, and we think that the reductions that are going to accrue from their Metropolitan Emissions Reductions Project is going to have a huge effect on this trend, as is Minnesota Power's project to reduce emissions. Now I'll jump in to talk about the activities that the agency actually does to work on the goals that we've set in our strategic plan and try to mitigate the trends that we're seeing and are concerned about. Probably the most fundamental aspect of our air quality program is our regulatory program. And this has been a program that's been around for a number of years and is really the primary mechanism through which we implement standards and requirements for facilities that emit air pollution throughout the state. We have 3,300 plus permits that we have issued to air quality sources in the state. And again, it's a wide range of facilities. It's everything from your small body shop to large facilities such as Flint Hills Refinery, mining facilities up north, power plants, things of that sort. We have 398 or almost 400 what we call individual permits. And these are, individual permits are specifically tailored for big, complicated sources and are quite labor intensive for the agency and require quite a bit of negotiation typically. We have 163 general permits, and these are permits that we can issue to broad categories of sources that are very, very similar in nature and tend not to have larger emissions. We also have 2,700 plus registration permits, and this is a program that we put into place in the 90s to try to efficiently and effectively regulate the many, many small sources throughout the state that emit levels of pollution that in aggregate are of concern. And these permits actually do put requirements on facilities to keep their emissions down to be able to qualify for these permits. Now, the permits are important because they set the conditions by which these facilities are going to operate. And it's not the case that when a facility gets a permit, they basically are getting a permit to do what they set out to do when they first came and talked to us. The typical process that we follow with the facility, especially with the larger facilities, is it's a negotiation process where we work with them to make sure that what they do and what they're going to be regulated to do is going to meet the standards that we think they ought to meet. Sometimes that's a simple process, and sometimes that can be complicated because they may have localized air toxics issues that we need to work with them on to reduce their emissions. What we're not able to do very satisfactorily just yet is quantify the outcomes of that work, and it's something that we are going to be actively focused on in the next couple of years so that we can tell a better story about the environmental impacts of the permitting work that we do at the agency. We have begun to do that in our enforcement area, which I'll talk about just a little bit.
I'm looking at the time, and I don't think we can finish air quite today because we're going to bring a couple slides back for us. So we did have a quorum today, and so I think what we're going to do is call the meeting to order, and also then if I don't see questions from members, we're going to adjourn for today and reconvene then on Thursday at 8:00.
Thank you.